This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 8th of December 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 231 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Steve Bloomfield.
Coming up on this week's show, we'll turn to the written word and find out what Katy Perry has in common with Charles Dickens, with the author of The Elements of Eloquence.
Also ahead, we'll take to the streets with investigative journalists Max Daly and Steve Sampson, who bring us face to face with the drug trade here in Britain and abroad.
And we capture some of the dumbest criminals through the ages with the author of Crap Crimes.
That's all to come, plus Alid John will be here with next week's news look ahead, and we'll be selecting some great music right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Here we are, Stevie, 231 episodes down, and the Dream Team are back together.
Yes.
That's how I like to look at these things, right? That's how I like to look at these things.
I think you say that every week, depending on who you're doing it with. In fact, actually, I said it when you were off on holidays for
you
weeks
said it
when and
I was
weeks and weeks.
I don't want to do it with you ever again then.
Oh, it's a bit harsh.
Who did you do it with when I was on holidays?
I did it with Tom Edwards a couple of times. And yeah. I did one very memorable show with Mr. Marcus Hippie.
Did you?
Yeah.
In what way was it memorable?
I remember it.
Steve just likes to point out Steve did make a face. How's the week been? It's been pretty, basically we're the only two people in the entire building.
We are. Everyone is sort of on the road in Singapore, in Brisbane, elsewhere. But, I don't mind because it's almost Christmas, Rob.
It's almost Christmas, Steve.
I've got my Christmas tree.
Have you?
Yes.
Oh,
I bought
man.
It last Sunday.
I think this time last year I'd got mine up and decorated. This time this year I've been a bit lax.
Oh, you should get it. It's important to get it. I think if you're going to do Christmas properly,
yeah,
sod it. The whole sort of month and a little bit. 1st December, Christmas tree goes up and the lights.
Maybe I should do that. Maybe I should get out there.
Maybe do it this afternoon.
I basically saw a place where, last time I bought it from somewhere literally around the corner from my house, I was very pleased with it, and it was the nicest one I'd seen anywhere, so I was really pleased with it. Whereas this year, I don't know, I don't want to have to go kind of hunting around, do you know what I mean?
Well,
Did you do the hike up the street with it in the net?
I did.
And it kind of and then you realise quite how painful it is when just one pine cone touches, or one pine needle touches your neck.
The guy sort of lifts it up and says, over your shoulder, mate. I'm like, okay, yeah. It goes over the shoulder. I'm like, yeah, this is all right. Yeah. I can do this. This is fine. It's only like a 6 foot Christmas tree on my shoulder, fine. Yeah. And then halfway down the road, like, oh, it's slipping.
It's,
and then, yeah, I had the pine needle just underneath my ear, just in there, digging in.
Let's not underestimate how sticky the sap is. Get that on your neck.
The sap was fine. That wasn't a problem. Just the needles.
It's a really crap version of lipstick on your collar, isn't it?
Darling, what happened to you? I lugged the Christmas tree home.
Have you got sap all there on your neck? Just get off me. things can only go uphill from here, I feel. I'm quite looking forward to the guests we've got on today's show.
Yes.
Elements of Eloquence, man. I'm quite looking
Easy
forward
for you
to
say.
Exactly. I don't want to get sort of tangled up.
I know.
It's
always
my
a problem
verbiage.
When you have someone in who sort of who talks about words.
Yeah.
You want to make sure that your words are proper good.
I know, exactly. I couldn't agree more, mate. I think what we're going to do is we're going to play some sort of weird sting. We're going to get out someone who's sailing his boat on the sort of maiden voyage of the news look ahead.
Yes, because as well as, you know, lots of other people being away, Tom Edwards sadly is away.
I didn't think they let him out of the building.
No, they just
kept him in a sort of radio cellar.
I don't like it when he goes out of the building, because it means that I have to do a lot of his work. It's not right.
It's not right at all, is it? So coming up next, Alid John will be doing the news look ahead. And in the news look ahead chair today, we welcome for the first time Alid John, Monocle producer. Alid, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Apologies for not creating an Alid John jingle like we have for Tom Edwards.
I heard you've got a great one for Tom.
He's got like a three or four. He's got a selection.
He has. He's got more than, in fact, anyone actually has.
He's essentially like a Kellogg's variety pack of sort of hilarious, kind of bombastic, histrionic, hyperbolic.
Mainly ones that mock him.
Yeah, they are mocking.
I'm disappointed that you don't have one for me.
Well, I'm sorry. But I think you probably have to come in. I think it's like you do two news look heads and then you get a theme.
Oh, it's like Earn Your Stripes sort of scenario.
Yeah, kind of it is.
Well, although you say that, Danny Jacopelli did it two or three times.
Well, he's got one.
And we didn't do one for him.
Really?
Yeah.
I've never done it with Danny.
Yeah, I've done it. These are the weeks when you're not here. They bring the B team. Tom's only here when it's A team.
Okay, yeah.
There we are.
I'll take that as a compliment.
I'm not sure whether you've been looking into a crystal ball or a snow globe.
Both.
And what have we got? What's going to happen next week in the world's news, Alan?
In the snow globe, I mean crystal ball, we have a selection of economic meetings, diplomatic meetings, municipal elections, trials of former dictators' sons, and...
Out of the list so far, that's my favourite.
Well, hold on. The final one is probably my favourite. Might freak you out a little bit because it's slightly reminiscent of the film Spy Kids or Agent Cody Banks, because Monday marks the end of the recruitment drive for school leavers to be turned into spies. This is a UK drive by the...
16-year-olds to become spies.
It could be 16, most likely 18, but Matthew Hancock, the skills minister, he spearheaded this drive to basically encourage kids to forget about university, but to go straight from school into the areas of spying that is relevant to their generation. So we're talking about online spying, coders. It's very kind of online focused. It's GCHQ sort of stuff.
So this is not just like people trying to make friends on Facebook when you've never heard of them.
Yeah. Next time someone does that, it might be because they're trying to spy.
Uh-oh, it's a coder.
Yeah.
So it's slightly scary, the idea that 16-year-olds will be, you know, solving our national security crises.
Yeah.
But I'm sure they'll be fine. Can we do the dictator's children, or do we want to save that to the end? Let's do the municipal elections, which is perhaps...
Cool.
I finally opened a letter from Islington Council.
We love a local election story on Monocle 24. So Venezuela's municipal elections are taking place next week. The date coincides with the anniversary of the last public address given by Hugo Chavez. Yeah. Of course, before he travelled to Cuba for cancer surgery, RIP. The polls will see the election of 335 mayors, 2,000-odd municipal councillors, 69 local indigenous representatives.
35 mayors, that's quite amazing. A lot of mayors, isn't
it? That's more mayors than even Andrew Tuck's interview on a spurious trip to Brisbane. There's a mayor there that I haven't interviewed yet.
I must meet some mayors.
I've heard it's hot at this time of year, but that's got nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with it at all.
Get me to my mayors. Nice.
So, yeah, they're taking place. Then, slightly more boring, but pretty relevant if you're in Japan. Two things, actually. Tokyo is hosting the 40th anniversary of diplomatic ties between the ASEAN nations and Japan. It's pretty boring stuff and often fairly not very newsworthy. However, the context of this is that there's a lot going on in the region at the moment. So even though China, Japan and South Korea aren't actually full members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, they're what they call the ASEAN plus three. So Tokyo is hosting the debate, and on the table, I'm sure, will be the creation of this new identification air zone around the Senkaku or the Diaoyu Islands in the Southeast China Sea.
Dictator's son, let's do that.
Okay. So the trial of Saif Gaddafi, LSE's favourite alumni, is taking place. Well, it's due to resume next week. It has been postponed a number of times. He's going to be standing alongside the former Prime Minister Baghdadi al-Mahmoudi, former intelligence director Abdullah al-Sanusi, and Mansour Dor, who headed the People's Guard. I mean,
I wonder if all of them will still have their fingers. Because, you know, Saif Gaddafi's lost some of his fingers.
Oh, really?
Since incarceration.
Yeah, they've mysteriously gone. Oh. Yeah, not good.
No, exactly. Yeah. Well, I expect, you know, when he was a student, he had other people to type his essays up for him anyway.
Definitely.
Yeah, and write them and come up with them.
And possibly come up with them. Right?
Yes. Well, in response to a friendly grant, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Why ever not? I like that news look ahead. That was a breathlessly delivered news look ahead. It was full of facts.
Yeah, Tom Edwards could learn a lot from you.
Yeah.
He often doesn't come with facts.
He's got a lackadaisical attitude to the news look ahead. It's a conversational, it's a different vibe, but I quite like that. I feel like I've learned quite a lot of things in the news look ahead.
I expect a sting or at least a jingle next time.
Okay. Yeah, well, let's work on that. Yeah, or we could just make one up on the spot, but I think basically our listeners will not only switch off their radios, but throw large rocks at them.
Yeah, let's not.
So let's thank Alan John for next week's news look ahead. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly. It's time now for us to turn our attention to the dark underworld of the global drug trade. Internationally, estimates place the value of the business in the region of some $320 billion. That's nearly 1% of global economy across the board. To put it simply, the drug industry is vast, interconnected and integrated into almost every aspect of our culture, cities and, of course, the economy.
Here in the United Kingdom, the drug trade is believed to be worth some $13 billion. The individuals that make up this business include its manufacturers, its dealers, its addicts, and of course those who try to fight it. A new book entitled Narcomania: How Britain Got Hooked on Drugs examines some of those key players and the underworld they inhabit. The two authors, Max Daly and Steve Sampson, spoke to Rob Ellis earlier.
Guys, thanks for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. First of all, I wanted to know, I'm always intrigued how sort of exposés of a trade, books are written on the exposés of a trade, how they're researched. Because presumably this is not the easiest people. People aren't that forthcoming. Drug users aren't that forthcoming about it, and certainly the people that sell them aren't. Mm-hmm. So how did you approach putting the book together?
Well, we had a head start. We didn't have a standing start. We've both been journalists writing and specialising in the drug trade for, I suppose, about a combined 20 years or something like that.
Right.
So yeah, we're in there already.
Yeah.
When we decide to write the book, we're in there. We have some great contacts in the trade, as it were.
Yeah.
So we've spoken to and met a lot of drug dealers, a lot of drug coppers, a lot of drug users, politicians, etc. We've seen news stories go through the media mill, as it were.
Yeah.
When we started writing the book, obviously we went full force delving into that world and dedicated a lot of time to going around the country, interviewing a hell of a lot of people.
And how interested are you in drug policy? We'll take the UK government because we're British around the table and we've obviously got the best idea of it. What's your take on drug policy? I mean, after having written the book, after it's come out and after reflecting on it and obviously talking about it for press and all the rest of it, does that seem backward? Does it sort of accept that drugs almost aren't a taboo anymore?
I think we're certainly not kind of blatant legalisers.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say. It's not that simple for us. It's a little bit more complex than that. But certainly we can say that the system as it is isn't working. There is a complete lack of experimentation in this country of things that may work. In New Zealand, for example, in Uruguay, some states in America, at least they are attempting some new policies and some new ways of dealing with things. So we think that policy in this country is kind of mired in some sort of inertia, really.
And what about the way that it's portrayed in the media? Whenever there's a big drug bust in a port somewhere, you know, that sort of gets reported. But sort of do people know? I wonder if it's necessary for people to sort of know and whether how it works, like how your book would explain it, but like how things get from A to B about how used drugs are just on a daily basis by people. Because there's obviously there's a kind of squeamishness in the press, I always feel.
I think different groups are portrayed using very particular stereotypes. I think if we look at the drug users, I think we've had cases very recently with the Reverend Flowers where as soon as somebody uses drugs, it pervades all their activities, regardless of how odd a cove he might have been. Also with the recent case with Miss Lawson. But also in terms of the actual industry, we still rely on very traditional stereotypes when we look at crime. So we're looking at an underground, we're looking at another world. Whereas one of the key things we found within the book is that most people that are involved in the trade are very ordinary people that do somewhat extraordinary things. And so when you imagine you're engaging, how you imagine you might engage with the drugs trade, on a day-to-day basis, it's with the people you'd least expect. And so it might be people in your community who are attending your neighbourhood watch scheme,
yeah, right.
Your community groups, all running your local nursery. We've got a very strange way in this country of viewing crime as often foreign and something other than ourselves. When I think if you look at the British banking system, we find that's not the case.
Right, exactly. And there is always that thing, it's, as I say, coming back to the idea of the media representation of it, it's obviously disingenuous, because obviously we know from all sorts of stories that have come out that some of the people writing the headlines and writing these stories aren't probably immune to the lure of drugs themselves, possibly. But the way that you're right, that it always does seem foreign, it's always, we're supposed to be shocked. And that presumably is desperately unhelpful when it comes to policy, because a policy, therefore, seems to be so alien into the way that drugs are reported.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of media reporting is obstructive to sensible policy and sensible discussion. I mean, obviously, you've got some tabloids, for example, the Daily Mail, who have a severe problem with cannabis. They don't like it. They want anyone who says that cannabis use is anything but abhorrent and evil thing to do, they will attack. They're like, you know, they are the media attack dogs. But what this does is it not only misrepresents the true facts, as I say, it strangles decent policy.
And it would be interesting to know about the people's attitudes to the different sorts of things, the differences between class C's, class B's and class A's. I mean, are there sort of tacit discussions being had within the police? Within the police, you said the drug coppers that you spoke to, that things need to change, that maybe things need to go up or down a notch on the scale of danger or of strength of drug.
A lot of the drug police we spoke to admitted that it was a game that they were losing. It was a cat and mouse game, that they were highly under-resourced in fighting. And there was a feeling that there's no way that you can stop the drugs coming in the country. There's only 1% of heroin coming into Scotland is ever seized. As soon as you get one drug dealer on the street, it's a bit like whack-a-mole, another one will pop up. There's an endless supply of people who want to earn money selling drugs rather than working in McDonald's. So police know they're on a hiding to nothing, really. They won't say that. Some police will say that publicly, most won't. And so I think now what they are doing is that they're doing all that they can in a more of a kind of acting like a public service.
So they're trying to be more of a preventative thing than a
yeah, or making a kind of a high profile bust and putting it all over Twitter and over the TV when they know that that's not going to stop anything. Mm-hmm. So it's all for show. It's all kind of window dressing.
And the way that one of the chapters in the book deals with kind of following the day-to-day work of a youngish drug dealer called Kareem, right, who goes into this hotel and night's vision and all the rest of it. This is an interesting way to write a book about drugs, is to kind of go be in the guy's car and drive around and see the clients he meets and all the rest of it. Is it, presumably it's chapters like these, it's writing the book in the style in which you've done it, or certainly in these sorts of chapters, that breathe life into it, and presumably for your Daily Mail readers possibly, and for every book, for all your readers, readers, show it the way it is.
Because we saw this book as a great opportunity to speak to the drug dealers. Yeah. No one ever cares what they say. They're always seen as the evil ones, although a lot of people will buy drugs from drug dealers and have friends who are drug dealers. And so we just wanted to kind of see what they had to say. And so we approached a lot of them, right from, the street right to kind of fairly near the top. And Kareem was an interesting guy. He was just a young guy from North London. He told us that he saw people in nightclubs drinking champagne with all the girls, and he got a bit envious of that. So he wanted a bit of the
high
life.
Working McDonald's, right?
Yeah. And he wanted some money, and he's a working class guy from an estate in North London. He wanted something else in his life. And he started selling cocaine to highly rich people in five-star hotels in London. And to him, that was almost a passport to another world. You know, he had got a kind of a pass card to a certain hotel bar, five-star hotel in London in Mayfair, where you could hang around with famous people, very rich people. He had a great time. He had a great life. He enjoyed it. He didn't see himself as damaging anyone. He saw himself as almost fueling the economy. The more cocaine that these guys snort, the harder they were working in the city, the more money they would spend in city bars. He saw himself as part of the modern economy.
And I suppose he is part of modern economy. I mean, that black market must be equally as popular as the champagne that's being quaffed. It's just not legal, presumably, and it's just as much of a fuel for a night out for tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people possibly, than any of the stuff that's on the other side of the bar, the legal stuff, presumably.
For sure. Some city bars were discovered selling cocaine along with their champagne, but Steve is he's an economic expert, and he can tell you about how the drugs' relationship with the global banking system in the City of London.
Right, I'd love to know about that. Yes,
I think drugs have two very key roles in the city, and one is in terms of this being fueled, and cocaine's role within the city. Where we were interviewing people who were dealing with the fallout in the wake of the crash, problem around cocaine use comes in the city when there are problems. Prior to there being a problem, somebody is just very productive. When there is a problem, then the issue of drugs, as we saw with the Reverend Flowers, suddenly becomes very relevant. On another level, and it's a very real level, the international banking system has got a near dependency on what people would call flight money. It's money in weakened states around the world where you have individuals, often very close to the government, who seek secrecy for money. And the banking system basically offers them, for a price, a level of secrecy, which some of us discover by now using offshore destinations to do our tax and to avoid paying what you might call legitimate taxes, that these centres also obviously attract those looking for secrecy from governments and law enforcers. And it's a huge sum of money that is constantly scooped up in and around the world, which isn't all directly linked to drug money, but drug money cuts across this money. So you have money from gun runners, money launderers, but drugs is the key revenue earner, which enables these other crimes to take place in many ways, and enables governments to be coerced, and enables local warlords to take control. So the City of London, as is Wall Street, is one of the great facilitators in this, and I think increasingly you will see the war on drugs and the war on terror converging into a war on a nexus of crime in which the banks have become key facilitators and key links.
And there's also a strange thing about, I mean, we mentioned cocaine specifically, about what you might call the behaviour patterns that might occur with cocaine use, right? Mm. There is largesse, and then there is crash. I mean, these are kind of metaphors.
There are many similarities between the highs and lows of a city trader and that of a cocaine user in general, I would imagine, in terms of the euphoria that's created around deal making. Scoring, the terminology that's used around buying drugs is that of scoring, of a successful operation, and the city is a 24-hour-a-day beast, and there have been casualties this year in the city of people regarding stress and overwork. While we can never tell what the situation really is, it is a city that thrives on adrenaline, that's for sure.
The word we kept on coming across, which relates to what you were talking about, was the word the buzz.
Yeah.
A lot of people were talking about the buzz. So like a drug user would get the buzz from their drug, the drug dealer would get the buzz from making a bit of trade, a big deal. The police would get the buzz from eventually catching the criminals they've been trying to find for 2 years. So everyone's getting some sort of buzz from it.
One thing I would say, going back to the city, is that cocaine doesn't stand isolated alone as a drug that's abused there. The big introduction to it, largely within the city, is their culture of drinking. So once a few glasses of champagne goes down, a cheeky little line of cocaine is just an add-on.
Narcomania, How Britain Got Hooked on Drugs, is out now. The authors Max Daly and Steve Sampson, thank you very much for joining us on
The
Weekly.
Thank you very much.
The Arctic has inspired artists for centuries with tales of adventure and exploration. Monocle Films made its own expedition to Denmark to see the Louisiana Museum's Arctic exhibition to seek out the past and the present of this mythic place.
As nations are vying for the north, negotiating trade routes and expanding development, and the Arctic landscape threatens to disappear, this exhibition takes a visionary stance that activates dialogue on every level, from science to pop culture.
Arctic Inspiration, premiering in the film section on monocle.com.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Mr. Robert Bound. Time for some music now. This is Warpaint with Love Is to Die.
That was Warpaint with Love Is to Die, and that's out next year on the 20th of Jan. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Steve Bloomfield. Now, it's one of the most envied skills you can ever really learn, the ability to write and write well. But how is it possible to truly construct the perfect English phrase? Do you need to know your alliteration for your antitheses, or is it all about the vibe?
Mark Forsyth is the author of a new book entitled The Elements of Eloquence, and in it he divulges all the tricks of the writing trade, or hopefully not all of them, because otherwise we'll be out of a job, to why we remember phrases like tiger, tiger, burning bright, to why it doesn't really matter if you don't have anything to say, you just have to know how to say it well. And we're delighted to say that we're joined in the studio by Mark now. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Now, I want to start with some of the words in your book, not the actual book itself, but about the author. It says here, Mark Forsyth is a writer, journalist, proofreader, ghostwriter, and pedant. Of those words, which do you think is perhaps most important when it comes to writing a book about how one should write?
Be a writer, really. Writing is
not pedant.
An awful lot of practice. No, not pedant. I like breaking the rules. It's important to know the rules before you break them. It's like, yeah, like if you're going to be a criminal, you should always know the law backwards.
Yeah, precisely, right. So you know how to jemmy open the safe.
Exactly.
And this is always the most interesting writing is writing that by people that know how to break the rules, presumably. Because perfectly correct writing is pretty boring, right?
Yeah, I mean, English, incorrect English can be incredibly memorable and effective.
Yeah.
Simples. I'm serious.
Precisely.
That's an absolutely perfect one.
And I guess the world of advertising, I'd also say for our international listeners that this is riffing on, I'm going to be awful and not know the product. No, it's an insurance company, isn't it?
It is an insurance company, and there is a meerkat from somewhere in Eastern Europe whose catchphrase is simples.
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah. I think it's... can I even say it on radio?
You can say it.
I think it's compare the market and compare the meerkat is the joke. Yeah.
That's it. That's exactly what it is. That's
Somehow it's been a huge success. but yeah, in a way, because it's got it uses words in a strange way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, same as we all remember the phrase, we was robbed.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't remember that if it had been we were robbed or something like
that. Yeah, right.
Or if he said, I mean, there's a beautiful one, our catacresis, is his Thunderbirds are go.
Yeah.
Now, that's all wrong grammatically as a sentence. That's just it should be Thunderbirds are going, but no one would ever have remembered that line.
Yeah, exactly.
No, it wouldn't quite work as well, would it?
No.
It would be quite as you wouldn't get your immediate hit of cartoonish fancy from the Thunderbirds are going.
exactly,
like going like hotcakes.
The important thing is so that's actually a technique like that. That's called catacresis that was noted down by the ancient Greeks 2,500 years ago. It's a very, very effective technique. And Shakespeare used it, you know, when he said, I shall speak daggers to her but use none in Hamlet. And speaking daggers, then looking daggers entered the language. But if you think about it, that doesn't make any sense as a sentence.
You can't really the visual as well.
There's any more than you can speak grenades or speak blunderbusses or something like that.
Yeah.
But it works because it doesn't quite work.
Do you think that, you know, when you look at the way people write now, thanks mainly to the internet, and just in terms of, you know, everyone writes far more than they used to because we write emails rather than making phone calls. And then obviously lots of people use social media and they're writing on that all the time and they're trying to fit phrases and sentences into small spaces. Often that sort of writing is criticised by people like you, perhaps?
No, not by people like me at all. I think it's a wonderful thing for the English language. Everyone is now having to sit and think about what you're writing. Because writing is like speech, except you get to stop and go, wait a minute, I'm going to change that word and go back and stop and think a little bit. And yet, when I was growing up at school, I never wrote anything to anyone in my class, anyone in my school, because you didn't write except, you know, maybe to pass a note at the back of the class. Whereas now it's all about that, and that means that people stop and think, and I think that Twitter and text messages and all this sort of stuff are really, really helping English.
And presumably the way that the sort of epistolary nature of the way that people communicate, it has changed that thing. And I mean, if you were going to sit down, I mean, there are people that are always trying to bring back letter writing, for example.
Well, that it has been brought back.
I guess it's brought back
and it's here.
Exactly, that's what I was going to say. And I guess the way that people talk hugely influences now the way people write texts and write on Twitter and all the rest of it, because it has to be that immediate, right?
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, text has come back and has even replaced an awful lot of talking. In offices I've worked in, it's often been the case that people don't even talk over the desks. Everyone's just emailing each other in this strange, silent way, and then somebody laughs. And
it is bizarre.
When you're writing like that, and writing for a purpose rather than just the friendly letter home to your mother or something like that. When you're writing an email in order to get a raise or in order to ask a girl out or whatever it happens to be, then you want to really stop and think about that email, and therefore people are stopping and thinking about prose an awful lot more.
And do you think that therefore means that it's more important for us to be reminded of some of the rules of writing and some of the history and the background to phrases that we use?
Yeah, because the rules are so very, very simple. It's really amazing how easy some of them are to make a memorable phrase. I mean, the Greeks identified one which is called epizeuxis, whereby you take a word and just repeat it, preferably three times.
Yeah,
and that's ridiculously
simple. It's like the sort of joke tellers thing. You need three things. A list has to be three things,
yeah,
and then joke comes in threes. Yeah,
just think of Tony Blair with his, you know, education, uh-huh, education, or weak, or Margaret Thatcher with no,
yeah,
or estate agents with location, or Tennyson with break on thy cold grey cliffs so sea, or King Lear's howl. It's all the same thing, and it's so easy to get into the dictionary of quotations.
Do you think it's something that, I mean, clearly you're hoping that people will find it something that they learn. Do you think it's something that just presumably comes natural to people? It sounds right. As I said in my introduction, maybe it's more about the vibe than about knowing why it's right. Although it's kind of nice to know you're in the right. Maybe.
It does sort of come naturally to you. It can come naturally to you. But I mean, the thing I wrote in the introduction to The Elements of Eloquence is it's what we're doing at the moment is we're all cooking blindfolded. Mm-hmm. If you just take a bunch of ingredients, throw them into a saucepan and boil them up, then every 100th time you do that, you'll get a nice meal. Right. But why not buy a recipe book and take the blindfold off, if you see what I mean? And the idea of The Elements of Eloquence was to just show all these tricks one by one, how they've been used, how easy they are, and then just, you know, go off and do them. This is the recipe.
And you've obviously chosen a bit of alliteration for the title of the book,
yeah,
which obviously helps. Some of the other things that we were talking about, I think Oscar Wilde's epigrams rely on something called antithesis,
yeah,
which presumably is there's only one thing in life worse than being talked about, and that's being talked about, and the other way around.
Yeah.
These are some of the tricks of memorability, because we talked about Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright, which is a bit of repetition and a bit of everything.
Yeah, and then you're Burning Bright, and then you've got a little funny antiptosis where he says, in the forests of the night. If you think about it, it shouldn't be forests of the night. It should be the forest at night or in the night or nighttime forests or something. And you've got a little bit of synecdoche, what immortal hand or eye.
Uh-huh.
One is saying, what god? You have the little bit of that god, you know,
the hand.
The eye. Same trick he used.
Calling a car a motor.
Wheels, yeah.
Yeah. Right.
And do you find there are any writers at the moment that you feel write in a particularly eloquent and stylistic way, and, you know, maybe even politicians as well, that have that perfect turn of phrase that may not sound right if you look at it properly, but feels right?
There are quite a few, because, I mean, to get to the top of politics, you have to have some little bit of grasp of this. But actually, the one that really surprised me when I was writing this, I kept noticing that these things are used much more in pop music than they ever were in Shakespeare. Even though Shakespeare was taught all this stuff at school, had it beaten into them, pop music is absolutely full of this, you know, just like ending every verse with the same words. So that's the thing called epistrophe, and or starting every line with the same words is a thing called anaphora. I noticed Paul McCartney has loads and loads of them. If you look at the opening verse of Here, There and Everywhere, it's anadiplosis, which is when the last word of one sentence is repeated as the first word of the next sentence. The most famous example is probably Star Wars, where Yoda says, fear leads to hate, hate leads to anger, anger leads to suffering. But it's the same thing in the first verse of Here, There and Everywhere, or Yesterday, which is an extended example of epanalepsis, where the first verse begins and ends with the word yesterday, second verse begins and ends with the word suddenly, third verse begins and ends with the word yesterday again. It's a great big thing. And I noticed Katy Perry. I love this one.
Because here we go.
There's one called a progressio, where you just have a long series of opposites, and it's immensely solemn and wonderful and memorable, and Dickens does it.
The Water Boys, I mean, the Water Boys always write, Mike Scott always writes in terms of opposites, and I was kind of it's an easy trick. It's quite an easy way of writing a song.
It's a very easy way of doing it.
It's only fitting a song with lyrics, anyway.
Best of times, worst of times, Age of reason, age of folly, or potato, I say potato, tomato, I say tomato.
Absolutely,
Is pop, though, in a way, does that make sense that pop music does that? Because it has to be, if it's going to be a success, it's got to be instantly memorable.
Yeah, makes an awful lot of sense. I just hadn't realised quite how much of it there is in there.
Give us some Katy Perry examples.
Well, that progressive, the best of times, worst of times, age of reason, age of folly, etc. Or you say potato, I say potato, you say tomato, I say tomato. You're hot, then you're cold, you yes, then you're no, we fight, we break up, we kiss, we make up. It's just that song, Hot and Cold, is just one long progressio, and it's beautiful. And putting next to Dickens or Ecclesiastes, Ecclesiastes chapter 3, you know, that great bit in the Bible, often read at funerals. Yeah. There was a time to be born and a time to die, a time to weep and a time to rejoice. And you go, Katy Perry, that same trick. That's why you remember both.
The Book of Perry.
Yeah.
That's going to go. That's going to be wonderful, isn't it? I don't know whether... Yeah.
I don't know where we go from there.
Recommend it at your next religious gathering, right?
Why not?
Always.
Why not?
It's an interesting thing. I wonder whether you feel that. I wonder how you were schooled in this, because I think I thought probably fairly old fashioned education actually. I sense that you probably did as well, learning these things. There's a joy in learning them and being able to sort of maybe even spot them and spot how they occur in everyday speech and everyday letter writing, for example.
Well. Yeah, it's lovely once you can see the world like this. It gives you a new little lens. I was just on a station platform the other day looking at the advertisements, and like the first advert was for an album. It was called Big When I Was Little, I think. Mm-hmm. And I thought, paradox. And next one, gambling website, it said, we don't stop playing when we get old. We get old when we stop playing. And that's a chiasmus. It's the same as JFK's, you know, mankind must put an end to war, or war will put an end to mankind, or Billy Ocean's, when the going gets tough, the tough get going, or whatever.
Ocean and Kennedy in the same sentence as well.
Does it bring in Snoop Dogg with Money on My Mind and My Mind on My Money.
Yeah.
Does it concern you at all that the best modern day examples tend to be pop songs and adverts rather than, you know, great works of art and literature?
No, it doesn't concern me at all, because maybe the pop songs and the adverts will be remembered as great works of art and literature someday. I'm not sure they all will, but it's certainly possible. You know, Toulouse-Lautrec's adverts are now all hanging in galleries all around the world. There's no particular reason, there's no particular reason to look down on pop music. Like, I mean, you know, and I don't think anybody does anymore. You know, you've got Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen and everyone else working away there. We know that will last. And I mean, that it was the joy of the Elements of Eloquence, putting these things together and saying, look, it's always the same thing. I like to talk about it like, it's like talking about, take an engineering analogy, talking about the arch. You can use an arch to build a cathedral or a railway tunnel or a humpback bridge or whatever it happens to be, but it's always that same structure underneath. And it doesn't matter that you can use it anywhere.
I like the sound of that. So say I. What about you, Steve?
I'm just stunned now into silence. I think that one of the problems of talking about this is you then start thinking about your words. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Mark Forsyth, thank you so much for coming in. The book is The Elements of Eloquence, How to Turn the Perfect English Phrase. It's out right now. Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Stand back from your letterboxes and tone up your biceps, because the biggest ever issue of Monocle is about to hit subscribers' doormats and newsstand shelves. The December-January issue helps you bid farewell to 2013 and look over the horizon to 2014 with our soft power survey, the Monocle 100, and our travel top 50. In the affairs section, we sit down for a series of interviews with global heavy hitters, from the President of Chile to the Australian Foreign Minister. We take a look at the Mexican President's to-do list, look at Japan's agenda for 2014, and ask 10 writers, academics and economists to give us their predictions for the year to come.
In the business section, we visit three model factories that are working inspirations for their industries. From a shoelace factory in Hanover built by the early modernist Walter Gropius, to a restored Renaissance village in Umbria making knitwear, and a Japanese brand that's so transparent, its customers are invited to pitch their tents on the lawn outside. These are companies who have created beautiful, light-filled environments for their production lines and are reaping the benefits as a result.
The Monocle December-January double issue is on newsstands now.
Now, we're fast approaching the end of the Monocle Weekly, but of course we still have time for one more great interview, this time with a humorous twist. Today we'll be poking fun at the criminal underworld. By all accounts, most criminals are pretty dumb, or else they wouldn't have been caught. From the classic story of Bonnie and Clyde to the true story of a woman who'd complained to police because she'd been sold poor quality cocaine.
There are millions of stories of criminal stupidity just like that. Enough, in fact, to fill out a brand new book entitled Crap Crimes, Tales of Criminal Stupidity. And we're joined by one of the book's authors, Martin Toseland. Welcome to the show, Martin. Now, I mean, it is one of those books that you, wherever you open it, you will find something a little bit bizarre. Where did the inspiration, was there one moment of one story you saw, perhaps in a local newspaper, that you thought, oh my God, why did you even begin trying to break into that bank on the day that, you know, the police were having a festival outside?
That kind of thing. Well, the one actually that sticks in my mind more than anything else is, it's actually my favourite one in the book still, and it's the two guys who obviously had consumed something during the afternoon and decided they needed more, so they were going to go and break into a house to see what they could get. But they realised they had no means of disguise, but they did have a permanent black ink marker, and so they proceeded to draw balaclavas on their faces. And
oh,
there's
fantastic.
A picture of them, and it's absolute genius. I mean,
because that is very good.
They are utterly crap. They are genuinely crap.
That's a very good start, actually. Yeah. The handmade, hand painted balaclava. Yeah.
It's like two
optimum disguise.
They've tried to black up very badly, as if halfway through thought, this is a bit wrong.
Yeah,
they didn't actually stop there either. They did the robbery, but they were seen, and they. Do you know what they realised? They didn't actually have a getaway car. So they had to break into a car where they were seen again. And then they were caught by the police driving down the road with these crap balaclavas on. So
Also, I guess you want to be slightly, you know, inconspicuous. You don't want anyone to really sort of remember what you look like.
Exactly.
If you've drawn on your face in permanent black marker, then people are going to remember that.
The police are currently searching for two men with permanent marker on their face.
Yeah.
It's taken them presumably 7 days to wash it off.
You're not going to be dissolving into the crowd like that.
No, you're not going to be dissolving into the crowd. It's a kind of nice idea. How did you research the book? I mean, how did these things come out? As Steve said, like local newspapers, especially possibly of an American or Australian bent, always seem to come up.
Exactly.
Whenever I find something recycled in the press, it comes from those two sources.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's all over the place. Obviously, the web is sort of a treasure trove for all of this.
Yeah.
But like you say, local newspapers, you know, all those sorts of places. And, you know, there is, I mean, without doubt, there is a degree of urban myth about all of this stuff as well, about some of them. I mean, we did try and verify as many as possible, but, you know, there is that sort of thing. So you try and strip it down to what was actually the real, the kernel of the story and see what was there. But yeah, it's all over the place, basically. It's whatever you can lay your hands on.
And do the police see the funny side of these things? Because, I mean, because presumably there's a bit, you can sort of win a bit of a war of charm offensive as well when you have to sort of come up and sort of say, well, look, these guys, you know. Yeah. There's a story in there, I think, about two people that, maybe it's in New Zealand, I'm not quite sure, who stole some frozen chips from a factory or something.
Yeah.
And then it snowed and they left their 2 kilometres of snow, perfect snow footprints in the snow.
To their front door. Yeah.
For some frozen chips.
Yeah, exactly. You really think, yeah, absolutely. And then there's another one who stole a cash register or whatever and sort of ran out. And of course, the money started flying out behind him. So they just followed the cash on the way, all the way back. But in fact, the police, I mean, one of my favourite stories in here is also that the police aren't necessarily above all this crapness either, because there's a great story from Mexico where they're in their sort of, what do you call it, the vault where they keep the criminal evidence. Half a ton of drugs went missing. They were accused roundly of the police of actually doing it. They were selling the drugs or consuming them themselves. And the police chief apparently was indignant. He was furious about having this accusation levelled at him. And he pointed to the cockroaches and various other insects. He said, look, they look completely glazed. You know, it must be them. They must have eaten everything.
the cockroaches have eaten the drugs.
But unfortunately, there's a journalist who actually snapped a picture the week before of a policeman on the corner by the police station actually selling the drugs outside.
That's great.
So it's perfect.
Why change out of your uniform to do it?
Well, exactly.
Why bother?
You know, you're above the law.
Now, having researched how to carry out a crap crime, do you think that this has perhaps given you an insight into, if you were to commit a crime, how you would perhaps do it properly?
Well, hopefully better than most of these people. I mean, I think, for a start, I wouldn't actually drink or take anything before I actually did it.
You've got to have a clear head for these things.
You've got to be crystal clear on all of this, you know. And planning has obviously got to be key.
I was going to say preparation, presumably, is
the
key.
I mean, there's a guy who broke into a CCTV shop without a balaclava, you know. Just a moment's thought when they suggest that you actually wear something that might disguise yourself. What else is...
I like the idea of a CCTV shop as well. Yeah. A man with a clear, you know, concept of irony. Or maybe such an amazing handle on irony that he just could not wait to be have his name in the paper.
That someone's going to break into his own shop and he wanted some CCTV cameras and couldn't afford it.
That's exactly what it was. And you've got to... You can't guard against this, but another element in all of this is just bad luck. You know, there's a guy, one of those classic ones where a guy walked into a bar in New York and bought a drink, but didn't have any cash, paid for it with a car, which was actually the bartender's card that had been stolen and passed on to the guy who's trying to buy the drink.
Fantastic.
Very bad luck.
That's particularly bad luck. Yeah. And is there, are there sort of geographical hotspots? We talked about the reporting of these crimes, maybe in the US or Australia or whatever, that seem to always be, maybe they're papers with a sense of humour as well.
Yeah.
But are there geographical hotspots where people are maybe less adept at carrying off the perfect crime?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you know, most of the stories I would say are probably from North and South America. Which is a rather large geographical
spread. It's a large geographical spread. Large enough for you to be able to travel happily to those two countries
exactly.
without fear of reprimand. It's fine.
We are travelling incognito all the time.
Exactly. Right. With that balaclava you've neatly drawn on your face in black exactly. marker, Martin.
I keep doing it every Sunday morning.
Now, obviously, as you said, you know, drink plays a large role in this. Mm. What are your favourite sort of drink-related crap crimes?
Well, actually, can I just shift it sideways to glue?
Yeah,
intoxicants of one kind or another.
Why not? It's Sunday after all.
Yeah, exactly. It was a Brazilian story about a guy who's a glue addict, which you know starts off quite sad and gets just actually really tragic. He broke into a glue factory in Brazil.
Wow, that's quite a lot of glue.
Apparently, he was after this ultimate. You know, it's like the finest Burgundy.
Yeah,
the Corton Charlemagne of glue.
Better than Pritt stick.
Better than Pritt stick. Uh-huh. And he went up to this vat apparently and took a great big hit off the glue, and got such a powerful rush that he fell over backwards, knocked the vat over, passed out, woke up hours later feeling great but really couldn't actually genuinely move. But it wasn't just his clothes that were stuck to the floor of the factory, it was his whole body. And this was a Friday night, and he wasn't discovered till Monday morning, and the fire engine apparently had to cut out him from the floor of the factory to do it. So that's possibly my favourite one, just for, you know, the sheer ambition of going for the best possible glue you can.
I mean, that really is. That's probably a cautionary tale on the power of addiction, presumably. Exactly. You couldn't just wriggle out of his clothes and sort of steal into the night naked.
No, because his body was actually
stuck. Oh, his body was, yeah, sorry, his body was stuck.
Yeah.
I love the idea of that. How many in there are sort of classic heist things or classic sort of, you know, robberies? Because robberies always seem to be the ones that are very, very capable of kind of going wrong, right?
Yeah, particularly with the lack of planning. I mean, there's quite a lot of them. My favourite one of those is a guy in Germany who... He did remember to wear a stocking over his head, but went in with a potato peeler and a water pistol to the bank. And
did that not work?
Surprisingly, the cashier just turned around and laughed at him, and he walked out very, very ashamed and embarrassed.
That's very good.
Going with a potato peeler.
I'm going to peel you to do a pencil sharpener, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, it shows a little bit of invention, maybe a little bit of innovation.
Potato peeler could sting, and let's face it, I wouldn't want to be.
Well, it depends how you're using it.
Well,
yeah. Anyway, perhaps not the most threatening object. When you're researching this, obviously there's lots of stories which, you know, would come up time and time again. And I'm sure you had lots of friends saying, there was this story I read about X. Yeah. And then you look into it and you realise, actually, it's not quite true. Were there any particular gems that you just wish were true but actually weren't?
There's one that was marginal where a guy walked into a bank, you know, stop me if you heard this before, and presented a $360 billion cheque. To the cashier, saying that his mother-in-law had given it to him. And, you know, you get those sorts of things where, you know, the variation on the theme is how much money it is or whatever it is. But actually, you know, you think, well, that seems to be just rank stupidity and there must be a kernel of truth there somewhere. But
if only he'd just taken like four of the zeros off,
exactly.
He would have probably got away with it.
I mean, they crop up from all over the world and the amounts vary. So I think, you know, that is the template of the sort of crap crime, if you like.
I love the template of a crap crime. Many more templates of crap crimes are in crap crimes. Tales of Criminal Stupidity. Martin, one of the co-authors, thank you so much for joining us.
That's a pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
So that's that, Rob. That was quite a show, really, wasn't it?
I think it was quite a show. It had its high points, its low points. When I say its low points, I don't mean any guest wasn't great. I just mean it kind of had a mixture of light and shade.
It did. And the high points were, well, we also talked about drugs as well.
We talked about drugs, yeah, exactly.
Or was that a low point?
That was, depends really.
Mm, yeah.
Depends what mood people are in, what people have taken while they're listening to the show, I think.
And who knew that Katy Perry was just like Charles Dickens?
I know. I know. I thought that guy was cool.
He was amazing.
He was a very interesting cat, wasn't he, about it, about that sort of thing. I don't think writing can be taught, but I do think that sort of...
Maybe
these things are kind of in the back of your head. I think we learned about all these things at schools. It's kind of nice to sort of remember the names of them again. Remember all the names of the things that you do accidentally and don't know what they're called, actually.
Well, indeed. And I don't... To be honest, I didn't know all of these names, I must say. It was a little bit of an eye-opener. Some of it, I believe. But no, it was great. And it's a wonderful book. And as we were saying, when the song was playing, Rob, it's beautiful as well. The actual hardcover book is fantastic.
I also like it. I love a crap crime as well. It reminds me of it. I had a similar book to that, actually, when I was growing up. And it had a robber. He robbed a post office in sort of East Yorkshire or something. And he came in and obviously decided to wear a disguise. And it was a motorbike helmet with his name, Clive Bunyan, on the side in massive letters. So that's always a good one as well. Any book, I love books like that. You kind of go, oh, what's this? And then you pick it up and then suddenly you've got to be completely absorbed in it for hours. And
yes.
They're always rather good.
I'm fairly sure that'll do very well at Christmas.
That's
as well.
another bit of a sort of Christmas classic. So we've kind of got to hand it to our producer, Phil Hahn. Thank you very much, Phil. And our studio manager was Jack Phillips. Someone will be in this chair, won't they, again next week?
I think it'll be you and Andrew Tuck.
Might
I think it'll be back
Andrew
by
Tuck.
Then, because it is production week for our February issue, believe it or not.
But for now, for me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Steve Bloomfield.
Thanks for tuning in.